is rather than me giving a talk, I would like to try to devote the evening to a little more questions and answers, so that partly so that I could hear the kind of concerns that are on your minds and the kind of interests that you have, and also so the rest of us can hear those kinds of questions and concerns, and hopefully that way the evening can be relevant directly rather than me guessing at what's relevant. And in order to warm you up, now that I've told you this is going to happen, so you can think about it a little bit, I thought that I would teach you a chant, a very simple chant, and would you like to know, it's in Pali, would you like to know the meaning of the chant before you chant it or after you chant it? Before? In case it's some kind of spell? This is the sentence. Nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. So that's, and the words are sabbe, which means everything or all. Dhamma is the word dharma, which in this context means everything, all things. And nalam. Nalam means not at all. And abhinevisaya, which means clung to or identified with. Sabe dhamma nalam abhinevisaya. So I'll chant it, we'll do one word at a time. And then you can repeat the word after me. And then once I think that we've gone through a few rounds and I think we've all kind of have it a little bit, then we'll just chant it all together. And you might think about this as you're chanting it, the meaning of it then. Nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. And see if you really believe that. And we can maybe, in our questions and answer period, we can discuss those things which, those exceptions which you have come up with. Sabbe.
Sabbe.
Dhamma.
Dhamma.
Nalam.
Nalam.
Abhi.
Abhi.
Nevi. Sayam.
Sayam.
Sabbe.
Sabbe.
Dhammam.
Dhammam.
Nalam.
Nalam.
Abhi.
Abhi.
Nevi.
Nevi.
Sayam.
Sayam.
Sabbe.
Sabbe.
Dhamma.
Dhamma.
Nalam.
Nalam.
Abhi.
Abhi.
Nevi.
Nevi.
Sayam.
Sayam.
Try it together. Sabbe. Dhamma. Nalam. Abhi. Nevi. Sayam. Sabbe. Dhammam. Nalam. Abhi. Nevi. Sayam. Sabbe. Dhammam. Nalam. Abhi. Nevi. Sayam. That's it. Thank you. You might use this chant at times when you're clinging. See if it helps. Something to hold on to, yeah. there is a principle that some Dharma teachers teach, is that rather than letting go of everything, all your clinging, what you do is you let go of that which is less useful to cling to and cling to what is more useful. Until you realize, after a while, after you do that well, and you cling to something good for a while, then after a while you realize that's kind of a problem, so you let go of that and then cling to something which is even better. And you keep clinging to stuff that's better and better and better until finally there's nothing left to cling to. And, or you realize that clinging to nothing is really the best. So in this strategy, you don't have to feel bad about all your clinging. You just have to do it progressively better. Until finally you can let go. So, yes, please, Marty.
I might have missed this in the introduction, but in the context of this chant, what is the meaning of the word Dhammo?
All things, things.
All things.
Well, Sabbe means all.
All.
And Dhamma here means things. Or,
things.
And it's in this context, it's anything that's a thing.
Anything that's a thing. How does this relate to other? I mean, how does it relate to Dhamma, for example? The other meanings of that word.
So the word Dharma, or Dhamma in Pali, has a lot of different meanings. There's one traditional Buddhist dictionary that gives something like 54 definitions for the word. One of the more common definitions that most of us might know is it means the teachings of the Buddha, the Dharma. And so there's a lot of different discourses of the Buddha. You can take Richard Shankman's class and learn about the Dharma, the direct teachings of the Buddha. A little bit more profoundly, the Dharma is not simply the teachings of the Buddha, but the practices the Buddha taught and the realizations that come from that practice. The kind of the insight the person has, the way the mind is changed, the realizations that come. And in a different way, the Dharma means, some people translate Dharma just meaning nature. Some Buddhist thinkers will call it nature. Buddhadasa, who's a famous Thai monk, he takes it to be the equivalent of the word God in Christianity or Judaism. And he raised a lot of eyebrows in Thailand when he equated the two. Not necessarily the same, but just the equivalent kind of status in their respective religions. But some people translate it as nature, the nature of things, the natural order. Buddhism feels that there's a kind of order to life, or natural way in which life unfolds. Certain things which are naturally true, certain basic laws of life. And so Dharma is the laws, kind of the laws, or the underlying laws of reality of life. In a more traditional Hindu or Indian meaning, which Buddhism fits within, Dharma means can mean duty. So your dharma is your duty as a, or your destiny, or not your destiny, I suppose, but your duty, your obligation, or your probably a better English word than duty, but your calling, that they perhaps something like that. But the word dharma also can just very simply mean thing. Oh, it also means mental states. There are six sense doors in Buddhism, the ways in which we perceive the world around us or in us, and they're the five senses we know about. The eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and the textile sense of the body. And Buddhism says that there's a sixth sense door, which is that's a place of perception within you that can recognize what goes on internally, your thoughts, your feelings. So if you're thinking and you know you're thinking, then the mind door is alert. All the things which the mind door knows are called dharmas, the mental things. So in some situations, it's very clear dharma means the world of mental content, in a sense. But in this chant, it means everything, because there's absolutely no thing which is worth clinging to, including the Dharma the Buddha taught. The Buddha gave a very famous simile of the raft, where he said, you don't know it. I mean, you don't know it, the raft simile. If a person comes to a river and has to cross the river using a raft, and there happens to be one there at on this bank of the river. And the person crosses the river and gets to the other side, and then continues on his his or her journey and into the jungle. But rather than leaving the raft on the river, picks up the raft and puts it on her shoulders and starts walking through the jungle carrying this big raft. And the Buddha asks, you know, is that a smart thing or not? And the right answer is, no, that's not smart. You know, once the raft has been used to carry across the river, you don't need it anymore, and you should leave it behind. So in the same way, the Dharma that I taught, the Buddha said, is like a raft. You use it to get across the river of samsara, and once you're across, you leave it behind. And so it was specifically, the Dharma was specifically, in a sense, the cure to clinging, but don't cling to that, please. Don't cure to, if you cling to the medicine, then it's hopeless. So don't cling to the medicine. And so it's the only religion I know about that, in a sense, self-destructs. Yes?
Well, the Buddha evidently left wife and palace and all. Does he have anything specifically to say? What about relationships with couples?
Yeah, the Buddha gave a number of discourses that were more specifically addressed to lay people. A lot of his discourses were addressed directly to his monastics, who kind of most people hung out around him. And there are some discourses in relationship to domestic life and family life. And you very correctly used the word partnership back then. In the discourse, one of them, for example, he really talks about husband and wife. And in our modern world, you know, we realize there are many more options. And he talks about the obligations of each to the other. And I don't remember what they are. I didn't memorize them. But, you know, a lot of them are just kind of common sense, kind of good, decent things, and offer friendship and support and confidentiality and, you know, kind of things like that. Maybe if you want, one day I can bring in that particular discourse and we can go over it a little bit. He talks about, there's a beautiful discourse where there's a Brahmin, I think it's a Brahmin son, and the Brahmins had a lot of rituals that they were supposed to do. And this Brahmin son, his father had died, and he had promised somehow to his father that every day he would honor the six directions. I think it was meant to be north, east, south, west, up and down. And so he was doing this, all his rituals, and he told the Buddha, I'm doing all this stuff to honor my dead father. And the Buddha said, well, that's a good thing to do, but let me tell you a better way to honor the six directions, a better way to honor your father. And then each of the six directions, he talks about some category of beings in life we live. Our friends, and how to honor our friends, our family, it goes around, I don't remember it so well. So he does have some teachings about that. But in a sense, it's more like common sense. The usual teachings he gave for lay people to help them with their lay lives were not directly connected to the path of liberation. They were more connected to the path of being happy, how to be happy, how to live a peaceful, harmonious life. And a peaceful, harmonious life being a different goal than liberation. And that's very interesting, because most of us maybe want it to be the same thing. We want to be happy, we want to be peaceful. But actually, the Buddha taught two different paths. And the path of Vipassana is the path of liberation. Yes?
So it's been about 20 years since medicine has tried to incorporate meditation as a therapy to help just normal people that maybe suffer from stress or stress-related illnesses. And in about the 20 years, it seems like there's been a lot of spin-offs of therapeutic uses of meditation and various people teaching how to make use of meditation in the average life. And since I've come to the Sangha and practiced a little bit and understood some of the content behind this type of meditation, I've been wondering what your opinion is on all these other versions of meditation, because it seems on one hand you're entering or creating a state that should be universal. But on the other, it really does seem like the content and the message affects both the depth, quality, and result of the meditation.
Very good question. So it's a very good question. I don't know if I can do justice to the good question, but I'll make an attempt. So kind of generally, as you started, I reflected on that I haven't actually taken the time, because it hasn't been my inclination, I think, to really formulate an opinion about people who do, you know, bring mindfulness to stress reduction and pain management and various kinds of areas in the health field. I mean, generally, I have a very good opinion about it. I think it's really great. It's fantastic. I mean, it's done a lot of benefit to a lot of people. It's very powerful. Mark Abramson, who does the work at Stanford, has been done a lot of really good work for a lot of people there. And other people around. There's other people in our Sangha here who have taught pain and stress, mindfulness-based pain and stress work outside of a Buddhist context in kind of various settings. And it's really been dynamic. And sometimes you have actually have much more dramatic benefits in that kind of settings than you have here. Because a lot of people come here, they've kind of read maybe a lot of books, and they're kind of warmed up to the idea. It generally fits into kind of somehow their worldview a little bit, perhaps, or something. But when they go to, you know, the doctor sends them, you know, to a stress reduction class as part of a hospital. I mean, some of these people have never heard about meditation in their life, you know, and they've never had a spiritual thought in their whole life. And so, you know, it's such a radically new teaching that sometimes the radicals of it can sometimes, kind of like beginner's luck, can kind of shift a person quite dramatically, very quickly. But not always in the best direction. Remember John Travis, who did this work for a little while. He's a teacher who, he's going to be here not this Thursday, but the next Thursday. He's going to be come teach our Thursday group. He was doing this work through a hospital, and there was a retired policeman from Los Angeles in his class who had a lot of back pain. And one of the basic kind of instructions in this kind of work is bring your attention on the pain. And he never heard that message before. I mean, the message he heard all his life was avoid the pain at all costs. And the result was he got furious at John, really angry. And John had to deal with all this anger. I don't know if the guy stayed in the class, but anyway, it can be very dramatic and very effective, very helpful for people. I think that there can be a difference in the context. I don't know if it has to be, because very deep awakenings, very deep experiences of awakening and realization can happen in any context at all. It's not really context dependent. It depends on a lot of different situations that kind of feed into it, besides the particular class or whatever. But as one friend of mine said, enlightenment is an accident, but meditation makes you accident prone. And I think that what happens in what can happen, I think, when there's a teaching. But what happens, I think, sometimes in stress reduction work outside of Buddhism, sometimes in Buddhism perhaps, but is that people get the impression that it's mostly about stress reduction, or it's mostly the message is about coping better, and it's a kind of a therapy. And for many people, they're trying to not coping very well, and a lot of struggle in their life, and stress, a lot of stress, and so they are using their Buddhist practice mostly as therapy. There's nothing wrong with that at all. It's actually necessary for some people for a period of their time, of their life. But in a sense, what one of the things that can happen is that they're actually developing a stronger sense of self, a stronger sense of self-identity, and stronger understanding of who they are. They might actually become a more relaxed, you know, peaceful soldier who goes out and has war, you know. There's all kinds of professions that maybe aren't so wholesome, or activities people do, that they get a little bit less, they just learn how to get more, you know, de-stressed as they do it. What the teachings of Buddhism offer, the practice of mindfulness, is a challenge that you really question very deeply some of the fundamental assumptions that you cling to, or that which you operate by. And if you really want to use Buddhism to go to its full depth, there has to be this very deep questioning that goes right down to the core of your very being. And without that very, without the kind of a context, I encourage you to do that questioning. Or without a kind of a container for the practice that allows you to develop a lot of concentration, so that questioning goes really deep, you're not going to be so accident prone. So, for example, one of the things that we encourage people to do who are very serious about the path of liberation is to go on retreats if they can. And retreats is one of the various things you can do to help kind of create a stronger intensity in the experience of meditation, so that you can get down to the down there to the very core, the foundation of your sense of self, and have the rug pulled from under you. As a spiritual discipline, meditation sometimes is very frightening. Whereas, as far as a stress reduction program, I've never heard of anyone being particularly frightened by that. They just, this is great, you know. I'm calmer, I'm less relaxed, I have less pain. But as when you really follow it through in a very serious way as a spiritual discipline, sooner or later you're going to encounter fear, because the very central kind of core way in which you've organized yourself and organized your perception of the world is called into question. And so then you want to be in an environment that understands that fear and understands that the possibilities beyond the fear, that helps you and provides you with a protective and safe environment to go through that. And I don't know whether kind of a standard secularized version of mindfulness could offer that deeper context for that kind of deeper work. I know some of my friends who are Vipassana teachers who have also taught this mindfulness-based stress and pain reduction work have been concerned that some of the people teaching the work are doing it without any background in meditation at all. They just go do a kind of a, they go to Massachusetts, they do a 5-week or 8-week or something course, and then they set themselves up as doing this kind of work. And they're probably very effective for a lot of people, but there are times when if they don't really have personal experience of what they're teaching, and they don't know some of the challenges people go through and some of the interesting places that might open up for them, they can't really be helpful. And it might actually be a little bit dangerous. Meditation is, you know, a little bit dangerous, you know. It's risky, you know. It has a certain element of risk to it. Did you know that?
No.
Good. I'm glad you know that. Yes?
I'm going to make a comment, if I might, about what you said about fear. And what happens, and I've experienced a number of times in different levels of something happening, or something shifting inside of me, that the fear has manifested itself in anger. And that's the kind of danger that when one does not know what's going on, that can, for all of us, be dangerous.
Yeah.
It manifests itself, as I said.
Absolutely. And so, for example, someone who's teaching, if they don't know that that's possible and all this anger comes at them, then they might actually just get angry back or do something unskillful. But hopefully someone who's well-trained, as in teaching mindfulness or teaching meditation, will understand that sometimes the anger will be directed at them or at other things, or and understand that as part of the path and know how to work with it. And the other thing that's very important is that it's also the same thing happens in therapy, which has been known by many people, is this kind of anger or frustration can build up. And because of the fear or the challenges that come with it, with kind of personal change. And sometimes it can manifest as anger outwardly directed. And one of the things that results from that is we often will leave. We just forget that practice, you know, or forget, you know. They probably have better spiritual practices down in Esalen where they have hot tubs. So I'm going to sign up for whatever's next there. So when there's a lot of frustration or a lot of difficulty or anger with a therapist or with a spiritual practice, it's useful to take it in stride and not to jump to conclusions and make decisions in the midst of the anger, but rather to somehow work with the anger and maybe talk about it. You know, if it's directed to the teacher, bring it to the teacher. And hopefully anyone who's a meditation teacher is willing to be the recipient of anger. Otherwise, they shouldn't be a teacher. Uh-oh. Yes?
We were talking earlier about Dhamma, and you said that
you're talking about the six sense doors, and that the six is kind of awareness of the internal state. And it seems like when we're meditating, that's more or less what we focus on. We're kind of diminishing the other senses. We're not looking, we're not listening, we're not tasting. And is that the case? And if so, what is the rationale behind focusing on that particular sense, and how does that kind of help us to reach awareness?
Well, that's an interesting question. So you all heard that. I think it was loud enough. So the question is, it seems to him that in meditation, we're primarily focusing on the mind door, of the six senses. I mentioned the sixth one is the mind door, internal door, kind of looking inwards. And it seems like it's the primary door that we're looking at in meditation. And then what about the other doors? How do we relate to those? And I don't think it's quite accurate. I think we tend to heighten our awareness of the internal life, the mental life, the thoughts, our reactions, our feelings, our emotions. But that's just one thing we pay attention to, and some people kind of give extra attention to that because they're very interested in our inner life. Some people have never paid attention to it, and it's useful to encourage them to pay attention to their inner life. Some people have never really paid attention to their thoughts before. Not carefully, not really to track their thoughts, to really see in the course of a day what they're really thinking about. And that's very valuable to do. But in pure mindfulness meditation, you're not actually choosing which door you're focusing on. It's more like the image of the six doors in Buddhism is sometimes depicted in an image of a house that has five windows and a door. And so each sense is either a door or a window in this house. And my extension of this is the practice of meditation is it's a one room little house. In the middle of that one room, there's an easy chair. And you sit there in the easy chair, completely relaxed and at ease, willing to greet whatever appears in any window or through the door. And you don't really care, you don't have an agenda, you can't even control what comes up at the different doors or the windows, but you just notice what happens. So if something arises in the window of the eye, you just note seeing. When something arises in the window of hearing, you note hearing. When something arises in the window of the tactile sensations, you're aware of tactile sensations. And when something arises in the window of a thought or the window of the mind, maybe that's the door of the little house, then you're aware of a thought arising or a feeling arising or a reaction arising. But you actually don't give any preference to either direction. And some people who teach meditation, a very traditional teaching is when you do meditation, you actually go neither outward nor inward in terms of your intention and what you're trying to do. You don't go out to the outer senses, you don't go inward either. You don't go either direction. You just sit in the middle of this easy chair and let the world just come to you.
But it seems like the way the process is set up, we're doing this in silence, we're closing our eyes, we're not moving, so we're not, Kin-Hin, you're discerning this aesthetics.
Right.
But it seems like the sort of the way it's set up, it kind of focuses you more.
Much more, yeah.
On that internal.
It definitely does, with the eyes closed and all that. However, one of the things that, especially for a beginning meditator, one of the things we're encouraged to do is to pay attention to the breath. Mm-hmm. And the breathing, the sensations of breathing, belongs to the tactile world, the tactile sense. And I read one story of a man who went to Burma to practice. And he was told to do breath meditation. And he went to his teacher and the first, second day of the retreat and said, I have all these, thoughts and feelings and reactions to what's going on here, and, let's talk about it. And the teacher kind of set himself up and with his full authority said, what goes on in your mind is none of your business. the instructions are to stay with your breath. And it can be a great relief. Just stay with your breath. Don't worry about that stuff. And some people get into that stuff of their mind, their thoughts and feelings, and they just, like, it's an endless maze, never get out of it. So we want to be careful not to be trapped in there either. We can talk more about it, but you've got to
see. So I think it's easy for Westerners, especially because we operate in our minds so much, to be confused when you're doing a simple noting, that instead of just noting when you place your foot in walking meditation hardness, it's a million things, gravity, et cetera, pressure. That's it. Those are concepts, right?
Right.
Okay. So it seems to just get to the basic noting of what's happening is, I don't know how to actually phrase it, but for me,
just
I sometimes get caught up in my concepts. And I don't even realize that I'm in concepts. But it seems like if I could just get to what is really right in front of me, it would make things a lot easier. I've said that in a very conceptual way.
You said it very well. You said it very concisely, and that's a really a very, very essentially important part of mindfulness practice, is to help us to see the distinction, difference between our conceptual understanding of life, which is how most people understand life, and what's actually directly happening in our senses. Because if you can start seeing the difference between those two, then you don't have to. You see, there's an alternative to your concepts. And also, if you see the difference between the two, you can see how your conceptual life gets born and gets created. And then you have much more control over it, and much more choice around it. And most people live most of the time in their conceptualizations. And sometimes it's in very abstract conceptualizations. And sometimes my abstract conceptualizations about myself and about you collides with your abstract conceptualization about me and yourself. And, you know, we never meet each other. It's just like these concepts are kind of missing each other, or, you know, clashing or whatever. And part of the function of mindfulness is first to help us slow down the mind enough, calm it enough, so that we're no longer living in those concepts all the time, and then give a chance to see something which is non-conceptual, the direct experience, the direct physical sense door experience. And for some people, that's a great relief to know that's a possibility. Just to stay with your breathing, very matter-of-factly. What goes on in your mind is none of your business. Some people, that's a great relief. I mean, I don't have to fix it, or I don't have to have good thoughts. I don't have to have different kind of thoughts. I don't have to have different feelings. I can just, you know, have those feelings and those thoughts, you know, and it's none of my business. That's right. Just, you don't have to be a good person. All you have to do is follow your breath, and it's a great relief. You know, let those things kind of be in the background. They'll relax. If you put most of your attention on your breathing. And if you notice there's any more attention you can bring to your breath, it's kind of just bring as much as you can to the breath in a gentle way. Everything else will calm down with time. Nancy.
I once had a teacher who, for walking meditation, she would recommend on occasion that I rotate the sense doors just to open me more. And what do you think about that? As just an alternative.
I think it can be fine. I can imagine myself giving that instruction to some particular person. It seems like a good instruction to do. But I've never given.
Not happening all the time, of course.
Yeah. I think it's a fine thing to do. I've never given that instruction. I think because I have a tendency towards letting the mindfulness be choiceless to some degree. So you don't necessarily choose which sense door you pay attention to. But if someone has a fixated personality, for example, and they start kind of being too narrow in their focus and not really aware of more parts of their life, then I think it'd be very useful to ask them to open up. Actually, one place I do that for some people is there's two general places where I've kind of encouraged people to pay more extra attention if there's a need. One is in their body. People who don't feel their body very much. And I tell them, you know, just spend some time exploring your body, do body sweeps and scans, and, you know, just do whatever you can to feel your body. And then the other is for some people to actually pay attention more through their feelings, their emotions, people who are out of touch with them, and some people are. And then sometimes actually I encourage people to pay particular attention to their thoughts, kind of cognitive therapy, because thoughts are very powerful and very important. And if you don't pay attention to them, you don't really notice a big part of how you're operating. Yes, please.
You mentioned earlier, you know, everything I've always heard about Vipassana is to be in the present moment, just the way it is, and just notice things as they come up. You were also talking about deep questioning of, you know, how you operate and stuff like that. So how do those two come together? Is that just part of the process of just meditating? That is a natural outcome of that? Or when you come out of meditation, you kind of reflect on what you were, what was going on, and then that's where the questioning
is. Good question. So the question is, for those of you who didn't hear it, she thought that she's heard that mindfulness practice is mostly just being present in the present moment for things as they arise. And I talked about the value of very deep questioning earlier. And how does this deep questioning come together with just being present for things as they are? Different teachers will have a little bit different teachings on this. Some teachers will actually encourage you to have specific questions. And as you get quieter and more concentrated, to use your power of questioning to really look very carefully at what's going on. Once you have the ability to be in the present moment, and the mind doesn't drift off a lot, and your concentration is stable enough, you can stay in the present, they'll say, then start looking at the different things that arise. And, for example, you can start questioning, is this myself? Is this the self? And that's one line of questioning that some teachers teach. It's very powerful. You just keep looking. Where is the self? Is that the self? Is that feeling the self? You look at it carefully, and usually after a while you feel like, that doesn't qualify as the self. You know, and so, okay, so what is it then? It must be something else. And you keep looking and looking and looking, and you start seeing that nothing in your experience really qualifies to be the self. Well, then what? And that can be very powerful to do that.
So it's a, because I'm relatively new, that's probably more advanced.
Probably.
That's what you're talking about. Okay, because I feel like, well, if I follow the questioning, then I'm going to get into my mind more, and then I'm going to go off on that trail. And
right.
Defeats the original.
What some teachers don't teach questioning so much, but rather what they teach is not questioning in terms of like with a question, but but it's sometimes described in the Zen tradition as always having a doubt. So whatever arises, you're gonna pay attention to it, but you're not gonna settle for it. So you're gonna look more closely. What is this? And so you're developing your concentration and mindfulness together, and get stiller and stiller and stiller, looking more and more deeply into your experience. And that's another way of kind of getting underneath the veils of illusion, to the core of what's actually going on. So there are different ways. But even for someone who's relatively new, I think it can be very, very valuable to do some questioning. It might not be in the context of your formal meditation practice, outside of your meditation, to do some reflective work, contemplative work, to use the calm you've acquired, if you've got a little bit of calm in your sitting, to use that calm as a foundation to start reflecting a little bit about your intentions in life, your values in life, your understandings of yourself and the world around you, and start questioning it, and use that calm to, is it really so? One of the interesting things that can happen, for example, from the perspective of meditation, is that many of the things we normally value in life can have a very different perspective, very different value from the point of view of the peace or well-being that come from meditation. If you know that if you've tasted a sense of great well-being in meditation that wasn't dependent on your how much of a promotion you got, what relationship you were in, what kind of financial security you had, what kind of house you lived in, what kind of car you had, you know, all these kind of things that some people are quite preoccupied about and they tie their happiness to. When you realize that you can have a deep sense of well-being without those things necessary, that changes sometimes your perspective on the value of those things. It doesn't say that they're invaluable necessarily, but just, oh, you know, I know a sense of well-being that's not tied to that, and maybe I won't put all my eggs in that basket then. So doing some reflective work at the end of meditation is sometimes very useful. Yes, Elizabeth. The last one, then we'll stop.
It seems to me that teaching, prove themselves again and again as being worthwhile, kind of surprisingly so. But I was wondering if, there are some teachings that you disagree with? And then if you do, how do you hold that? Or how do you, like, what criteria do you use? Or do you just say, oh, well, don't like that one, I'll just ignore that over there? Or do you have some criteria or something that you disagree with? Or how do you hold things? Because the teachings, I mean, they kind of build, it kind of builds up a certain level of trust because they keep proving themselves as being worthwhile.
Well, this was a good question. So, I mean, in the teachings of the Buddha, for example,
yeah.
You know, so how do you decide which ones are worthwhile and which ones are just a bunch of baloney? And who am I to decide the teachings of the Buddha are baloney? What criteria am I going to use? You know, so I'm going to give you an example. There's a teaching that says that women cannot become Buddhas. Now, is that baloney?
You bet.
Or you bet? And upon which criteria are you basing that opinion on? On whose part?
On the part of whoever said it initially.
I see. So you know, I think it's pretty dumb. But, you know, am I going to stand up in face of all of Buddhism and say that's not true? I think so. But I prefer not to have an opinion. I'd rather not even talk about or even look at that part of Buddhism because we can do quite well without it. None of my teachers ever brought up that teaching. All my Asian teachers never talked about it. It was never seemed to be part of it. The only reason I knew it was part of Buddhism is because I read some old, musty, ancient text that said it. And then we get upset and get, you know, but just an ancient text. So Elizabeth's question is, you know, upon what criteria do you use to decide whether some teachings are true or false? And that question was asked to the Buddha. And the Buddha gave a number of different answers to that. And he said, you have to consider this carefully. And he said, you know, if it's in very broad strokes, he said once, if it's in line with the teachings in general, then it's fine. But more specifically, he said, very interesting, a number of places he said, if the teachings are conducive to disenchantment, the fading away of greed, hate, and delusion, and to liberation, then you can be reassured that it's part of the teaching. And what he means by disenchantment is disenchantment. No longer being enchanted. Not in a nice French way, you know, which whatever, you know, it's kind of, but rather, you know, living in illusion. So if it helps you break through the illusions of your concepts, and then helps you to have a fading away of your clinging, of greed and hate and confusion and all that, and leads to the experience of not clinging at all, then you can take that to be the teaching. So that was one criteria he used. And for me, what that means is that it makes the teachings very simple. And it's like kind of like the raft. The raft is actually, you know, it's not like an ocean liner or some fancy yacht or, you know, the raft is just really simple, very simple. You kind of tie some pieces of wood together and you go across. You don't need a lot. The Dharma doesn't require very much. It requires very little props, very little ritual, very little. In a sense, the non-clinging requires nothing at all. And if, in a sense, non-clinging is the deepest teachings, the deepest experience that Buddhism is pointing towards. And non-clinging requires nothing at all. So, you know, as we look, you know, are these teachings helping me not to cling? If they are, then great. If they're helping you to cling, then be careful. I went to a, maybe I shouldn't say this just before you brought all to leave, but I get the wrong message, but when one abbot that I saw in Thailand, he told me, if you go to a monastery and you find that the teachings and practices there are useful for you, then stay. And if you find that they're not useful for you, leave so quickly you don't even say goodbye. Now, I disagree with that. And the reason I disagree with that is that I think that if you disagree with someone, rather than just leaving and just saying, forget that, I think it's best for everyone concerned that you come and say that. Say, you know, you said something and I don't really agree with that. That doesn't really work for me. And, I'm going to go to Esalen or whatever. I think it's really helpful. And for everyone concerned, it's respectful to do it that way. And it gives everyone a chance to kind of help clarify. Because I think everyone's a student. Teachers are students as much as students are students. And so if we just always walk away, then we all lose an opportunity to learn. But I like it anyway. The message was still, it's very significant to say that if it's not helping you, that you should really then act on that and don't just be complacent. Yes?
Just a quick clarification. You said that you read in some sutra that women could not become Buddhas, but when Ananda was arguing for the ordination of women in the original Sangha, wasn't one of the questions he asked, it was whether cannot women become enlightened in the
more equal than others. Buddha is kind of a little bit special. For example, a number of people now have walked on the moon, right? I don't know, half a dozen or so people have walked on the moon. But the first person to walk on the moon is really a special person. You know, we kind of think that guy's really, something amazing. So a Buddha is always, by definition, the person who discovers the Dharma for the first time. And the Buddhist cosmology says it's actually is the kind of yo-yo theory of the cosmos, that worlds arise and they pass, and they rise and they pass. And our particular world system, we have Shakyamuni Buddha, so we can't be any more Buddhas now, we've had ours. Eventually, the sun will collapse, and our world system will disintegrate, and then a new one will arise. And then they'll have to have their own Buddha in the future. And, the discoverer, the person who discovered it for the first time. And the teaching is that has to have a certain particular gender.
Assuming that the next world that arises has gender.
So I hope that this was useful to have the questions and answers this evening. And please remember this very important, if not the chant, at least the teachings of the chant. Nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to.